Good morning, everyone. Please welcome Trevor Grant from IBM. He's talking about an Apache-based intelligent IoT stack for transportation.
How is everyone doing? I am Trevor Grant, and I am talking about an Apache-based intelligence stack for transportation. I can put all that on there. About me, this is worse than, I can't see what's going on. All right, I'm gonna pause X real quick. I don't like the way this display thing's set up, sorry. About me, my name is Trevor Grant. I am an open source technical evangelist for IBM. You may have heard I'm a PMC for Apache Mahout. Somewhat vocal about that. I'm on Twitter. Okay. Big shout out. This was supposed to be a two-person presentation originally. Joe Olson was kind of the brains of the outfit. He's built this as a POC, put it in production. I was just kind of the machine learning piece on the back of it. I understand most of the points. However, I'm not going to claim to be like the deep expert. So I'm gonna do this peanut gallery style, and everyone can feel free to chime in with better ideas as we go. So we'll go with that. In general, there are four stages of any IoT app. Collect the data, store the data, you process the data, you analyze the data. Commercial, open source, however you want to swing it. These are the four things that have to happen, and yeah, it can happen on the edge, it can happen centrally, multiple places, but those are your processes. So for our stack, this is what we have. The idea is we'll collect data, pipe it into Kafka, use the Flink to suck up the Kafka and process it, and then also analysis. So again, if you've been here, odds on you've run into me preaching Mahout, and I will continue to do that today because it is an Apache stack. But everything I'm saying about the machine learning piece will generally apply to machine learning algorithms from any different, you could use DL4J, you can use your R, you can use your Python, whatever the case may be.
What's the MC3 on this?
We will get into that, but the short is the MC3 is a proprietary, you buy one and just plug it straight into your ODB2 port.
Oh, okay.
So, but no, that's a valid question. Slide orders, not necessarily on pre-selling. So the device level of this little stack, we're gonna collect things. Modern engines have a lot of sensors, if you may or may not know. ODB2, as I recall, came out in about 1995. It was a huge improvement over ODB1. ODB1 was a really cool thing. I've actually, as a hobby, played with ODB1 computers a lot. They had mass airflow. It was the first iteration of an engine controlled computer, or an engine control computer that had some sort of standardization to it. Back through the 80s, it was a lot of, we have engine control computers, but everyone kind of hip shots their own. There's no real standard. So Nissan's got one and Ford's got one. And everyone has one, and they even differ so much between models. And so the auto industry gets together and they come up with the ODB1 standard. It was in, I believe, effect from 89 to, about 94-ish. And then in 95, well, I'm sure they were building on it as soon as ODB1 was out. As we do in tech, they're like, awesome, we've got something in production. I've already got 100 new great ideas for the way we should do it next time. And the ODB2 was launched. And the ODB2, I believe the big change was it was scalable. The ODB1 had like certain things it was going to do. But it kind of boxed itself in on how much it could put out, how much sensors it had. Really, at the time, the idea was, wouldn't it be cool if we had an engine control computer that could just throw an error code to give you some sort of clue what was going on? Nobody had the idea of, like, let's hack into this computer and read what's coming off of it. The ODB2 is a lot more set up to do that sort of thing. So, at any rate, back to my story. Temperature, humidity, barometers, fuel position, the fuel mixture that you've got in your tank are all things that were ODB1, and I think now the ODB2's hundreds, if not upwards of thousands of sensors going on the computer. And all this comes into the engine control computer and has a built-in, you know, system to figure out how to mix your fuel and figure out the headlights are on and what it should be doing and all this. And it will also kick this data off for you. So that's what we're plugging into. All these sensors are coming into an engine control computer where we have an engine control module, blah, blah, blah. Enter the Mori MC3. No particular reason that we're plugging this company or product, other than the person who had done the original POC, this is what they used. You get them for about $225 on Amazon, you get it, you plug it into your ODB2 port on your car, and it's great. You can get up and running with a POC for pretty cheap. It's got its own little libraries that come with it, blah, blah, blah. Since it's an Apache-based stack, I would say, get yourself a Raspberry Pi for $25, and you can throw some Edge in, you can throw some different things on that little Raspberry Pi. There are ASP2 licensed projects that exist for reading the data in from the ODB2 sensor and converting it to something useful. So that's the theoretically, that keeps us theoretically pure from top to bottom on Apache stuff. So there you go. So this ODB2 sensor is kicking off data that gets processed by whatever that first layer is that we'll say gets muxed around, and we're going to turn it into JSONs. I'm not going to magic hand wave on that, but I think I'm not making an excessively bold statement that we can take binary packages of data and turn them into JSONs. Here's what the JSONs look like. Altitude, latitude, longitude, timestamp. Kind of looks like log IDs that we would see or anything else. Battery millivolts. On this particular model, as I recall, this is not an exhaustive list of everything you can get out of an ODB2 sensor. You program these little plug-in modules to say, like, what kind of data you want to read. In this case, I'm not sure what the thing they were going for was, but that way it's not trying to, because that little module has a little modem built into it too that will fire up to your Kafka or whatever. It can send its data to the remote thing. And obviously for any kind of real application, you don't want to be dumping in all of the engine stuff. You want to be keep it light and lean and just be kicking off what you want. Similar problems we have in IoT in general. So the stream processing side of it. This is going into the store part of the phase. All of these binaries are coming in, and in theory, you've got all these JSONs coming across, and in theory, they're all coming across from an entire fleet of vehicles. This is the example we had. It was one, but you want this to be a scalable solution no matter how you fire anything off. So we start with the idea of, let's tie one hand behind our back and say that this, whatever we're building for one, we should be able to scale up with to big without any trouble. So, okay, we've got Kafka coming in, just reading these JSONs as they come in. Stores everything there, and that's really, really helpful for later when we want to maybe replay the logs, do training on it, whatever the case may be. And then wherever that Kafka's got it coming in, can then write it straight to Flink. I thought that slide was built out a little more, so let's just talk over it. Apache Flink is a complex event processor. A streaming engine can also scale out really, really large. You got more and more torrents of data coming in. And a big question is, it seems like we just bolted two streamers together. And that's fair, except in a toy example, like if all we're trying to do is collect data, Kafka will probably carry the day. Flink has complex event processing, windowing, real-time analytics, and so when you start building out any kind of real system around this or doing anything more than just trivially saving information to disk, then you're going to want to have a really powerful streaming engine on the front of it doing, you know, aggregates like how many vehicles do I have on the road at the moment? How many vehicles have the ignition switch on? Trivial things to do in Flink makes it really, really easy to sort all that out. And then doing, you know, just fleet metrics. How many people are familiar with Flink? Sorry. All right, cool. Well, then this is going to be an exposition on Flink that I wish I had slides to back me up on, but here we go. Streaming in general is a fun and kind of rough thing to do. You've got a lot of considerations to take into account. You've got, as data's coming in at you, you've got back pressure. You've got, semantics. There's a bunch of Apache streaming products out at the moment. Everyone's got their own little slice. Flink is one of my favorite. It's heavy. It came out of Germany, and I always laugh. It's like the Panzer tank of streaming engines. It's heavy, but it's very well engineered, and it runs like a sucker. About cursed on my recorded talk. and it just really, really runs. So it's scalable as well. You start with, you know, in like any other distributed cluster, whatever, you can have a cluster of as big as you need processing these things, and you can do real time, like your aggregates. You load everything into a window, you got your windowing functions, a lot of really rich windowing functions on how you're gonna window things up. And so in the case of like this data streaming in, I'm gonna window, let's say I wanna window on like, you know, in the last hour, what's been going on? How many vehicles do I have right now? I'm reading all these sensors. What's my average oil pressure across all of my things on the vehicles on the road? Which is a silly thing to ask for, but it's very easy. And there's like SQL that you can run on these tables. You can run SQL on your streams. Anything you know about any streaming engine, there's a good chance Flink does it, and it does it very well. So there you go. There's your my nickel pitch on Apache Flink. As I said, it's complex event processing. You're gonna start doing weird stuff. Flink, you're gonna need a stronger base than Kafka. Kafka streams, unless you're doing something really trivial, like just saving the data, is probably not gonna carry the day for you. Oh, sorry, let me go back.
Okay. Why do we need Flink?
Yes, that would be a better one. Oh. Yes. Why do we need Flink? Because it's a convex bot. Valid. The good question though is why do we need Kafka? Why can't we stream just into Flink? and the reason is Joe told me there is an issue on the read side, and I think it had to do with the storm. That doesn't make sense because you could sync it. You need it. I'll give you Joelson's email. If anybody wants to know, you should email him. I highly recommend it.
Does Flink include storage?
It does. You can sync. Yeah. So that's no, not at all. And so that's why I was like, at first I was something about storage, but you can have Flink just like, you know, you can just sync it to disk. You can just save those records as they come in. But when it
can, would like pub sub model that like Kafka, right?
I don't think so. No. We've got one of the committers, PMC, of Flink sitting in here. I should have let him just. You wanna go out my talk? I need help.
Good.
Okay.
But you're right. There's no storage thing. So
that's why. So when Joe is, oh sorry, go ahead.
What's the main difference between Storm and Flink?
Storm. So Storm was a great first crack at streaming engines. My short answer is that when you try to do anything with Storm, Storm is written for Twitter. And when you're trying to do anything more than like arbitrary, like not very worth much tweets coming and going, you're trying to save like more useful data and do anything more in production, you instantly start having to bolt things onto the side of Storm. Like, you know, if you want exactly one semantics, you got messaging, you got this and that. And when you keep bolting all these things on, now all that low latency from Storm, you've lost it because you've got this like bubblegum and baling wire system that you've rigged out with Storm. So Flink, having the benefit of starting later as a project, saw like these things are important on any real streaming application that is not tweets. We should bake this into its bones. And so that's why it's big and heavy, because all of those things that you need in Storm are just there and they're in there. There's And so you get them for free, but you get it optimized. You know, it's not, everything's working together. It's expecting that you care about all your data and it needs to make it through. You care about, you know, checkpointing. You care about having a tape. You care about all these things. And that's why Flink instead of Storm. You could, building your own, sure, maybe Storm. I don't, but I like Flink, so here we go. It's my Apache stack. I was going to say something else. I lost it. So this is the part that I can really expose on. So, moot, back in. But I'm okay. We can, let's dance around on this open questions on this streaming part of it. So far, the idea that I'm taking data from a car and getting it to a server, I hope I'm selling at this point.
Actually, the preceding stage, I was curious about Kafka as a messaging engine versus the use of, say, like an ActiveMQ or something for MQTT. Do you have any insight as to why that selection might have been made?
Connectors and MQTT for Flink, there is. Then I would say, most likely, Joe's more familiar with Kafka, and he built it. It's you need a streamer, or you need something like the message queuer, you need the streamer, and I think it's like so often. What's the quick one that I can? What can I pull off the shelf and get something rolling really quick on? And if you're more familiar with Kafka, I think that's the only logic I can give.
There was a previous talk from some folks from with about Kafka and tuning and this. It's a bigger automotive. Then they said they front-ended it with an MQTT because that was sort of the predominant communication protocol
for
like vehicles and stuff. And then they just immediately went from MQTT into Kafka.
Okay, interesting.
They were front-ending it with.
Very interesting.
They just said, yeah, you don't want to do it with Kafka for straight on for some reason.
Okay.
One of the reasons that Kafka like doesn't support MQTT on the box, so you need something to front-end. But there's another challenge as well. If you use Kafka in this scenario, you have just way to get from the cars to the backend. But if you need to talk to a car, you don't have a solution.
With Kafka?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's good information. The question was why Kafka, not MQTT? And the answer was that MQTT will talk back to the cars.
And MQTT, Kafka doesn't support MQTT.
And Kafka doesn't support MQTT out of the box.
Their recommendation is to use a broker like Mosquito or ActiveMQ or some other that supports MQTT.
All right, cool.
The cars, are they directly connected to Kafka or is something in between with some buffer, some whatever protocols uses directly HTTP to Kafka or even native to Kafka? Can't think of it because the network would be unreliable for cars.
I agree, and I don't think so. I believe he was just driving in areas that had good cell service, so that because this thing, okay, come on, this thing I believe runs over like a 3G network or just like a cell phone network, and I think he just drove in areas with good. I do not believe to answer your question. Well, that would probably be very important. I do not think he had any buffering. And just tried to stick around to places that it was an okay network. But a good thing to think about too. Yes?
Is there a difference between Flink and Apex?
Yes, there is. And I don't know enough about Apex to dive into it in a proper way. Is the short answer on that. You should definitely talk to the gentleman behind you after the talk, and I'll jump in and listen too, because this keeps coming up more and more, but yeah, I don't know Apex well enough to speak to it properly. Cool. Good. All right. Getting to the intelligence part. Again, I always pimp my favorite project, Apache Mahout. And it is, as far as machine learning goes, general machine learning frameworks, best in the Apache stack. So We've got two things that we're going to look at with it. We're going to look at MLPs and correlated co-occurrence. Both, one is very well supported and has been around and moved for a while. The other is 3/4 of the way done, sitting on my laptop, and I will hopefully have it in over the weekend. I had a kind of an emergency thing doing these slides because I didn't realize I was doing this talk by myself, so I didn't finish it up. That was my bad. But deep learning multi-layer perceptron is a type of neural network. Deep learning is usually multi-layer perceptrons or their cousins on a bunch of layers. It is not my favorite type of thing, but there it is. CCO is a recommender. It is a multimodal recommender that allows you to have, you know, if you think of like the traditional ALS, the Netflix, the recommender demo, it's, you've got one action, usually ratings, and you look at the ratings of one person, you find somebody else has other similar ratings, and you fill in the blanks and figure out what they might like. First of all, in practice, ratings are found to not be a great indicator. You get, especially in e-commerce solutions, less than 1% of people rate things, and even then it's only because they really, really liked it or really, really hated it, but you don't have usefulness. And really then all you end up doing is like recommending things that it doesn't work out so well in real life. On a correlated co-occurrence then, you have, let's say, items purchased, but also pages viewed, things left out of cart, location, category, color, as many, you can get as wide as you want with extra actions and things. So how are we going to spin this to an automotive case? This would be an overly simple version of it. You could recommend what kind of maintenance, the level of maintenance. You can recommend, you know, you maybe need an oil change. This is, it's funny because recommenders have kind of fallen out of like, oh, that's not machine learning, that's not AI, but really, this is the basis of cognitive, and I gotta be careful saying that because I'm a good IBM. But this is the basis of like, you know, the cognitive assist kind of artificial intelligence, where it's not telling you what to do and somehow magically predicting the future. It's just saying, hey, it seems like you're driving really fast. Would you like to listen to some heavy metal or things like that? But it's still a cool thing. You know, that's like that kind of Jetsons-y robot stuff that makes it all work. So in this case, all right, so viewed items might be like, you know, one of the secondary actions, but as in our automotive case, each one of those sensor statuses can be a secondary action. Our mileage, you know, the ODB2 error codes, the driver's technical ability, how long has this driver been working, and the math. How many people here care or like math? Okay, all right.
More than I was expecting, so let's walk through it.
The way, a big problem, and I'm gonna get into this, that neural networks are very intractable, they're hard to follow. The beauty of this system is it's mathematically very simple. You've got your primary action, let's call that matrix A. And that's a matrix, if you'll imagine, of, you know, products. I'm gonna do the e-commerce because it's easier to like visualize. But you get your products, and then you have users. And then your secondary matrix is like, you know, location and users. And everything gets keyed off of like the same row space. And when you do that, you have, take ATA, your primary matrix, ATB, ATC, so primary matrix transpose times secondary matrices. And then you take the log likelihood ratio. That is a test for correlation, I think, or co-occurrence. I forget. At any rate, by taking the log likelihood ratio, even though these were different things, it's a test and it gets them into like a comparable number so that we can add them. And then this would be a history vector of this particular user. So user, you know, driver 256 or car 27 or whatever the case may be, you take the history, the sensor status of that car that, you know, corresponds to those columns. And then you add it all up and you get all of the items that were in the primary actions are now recommended. You know, you have to down sample that slightly, but that's it. I mean, it's kind of a little bit, but
That's pretty easy math to follow, especially if you've ever looked through back propagation, which is a mess. So that's a real awesome value or advantage of it. Like, this is attractable. It's not black box. It's pretty, and it's very simple to compute. Not simple. It's not terribly difficult, but it's cheap to compute. Also compared to like spending months back train, you know, back propping and training a matrix. So also to be fair, when you have a really awesome hammer, every problem is a nail. And who has really, really awesome recommenders, so of course recommenders are the things we should use. But also is good because easy to understand track, efficient and scalable, the scales linearly. You can also add expert knowledge in, which is a cool thing. Like when you think of like doctors training AI, well, this is what it is. They look and they say, oh, this is what we should have done in that case. And like that's how you build your training set. You let an expert train the machine and then it can learn and it can extrapolate from that. So, multi-layer perceptrons, on the other hand, are significantly more complicated. Okay, so if you had a linear regression, this is how I would graphically represent a linear regression. You've got these x variables, and you have betas, and you those are the weights, and then you can come up with a y. It's, again, if you know, I do this because people usually know linear regression. Okay, I get this graph. If you get over to this mess, we call these alphas. And they all, it's all interconnected, and you have to train each one of these things, and then all the way up to here, and they do that by taking an error term here, and then it gets back-propagated to here, and then back-propagated to here, and back-propagated to here. It's not super vicious, but it's not quite as straightforward and simple. And this is a trivially small, this you wouldn't even call this deep learning, you call it, this is a multi-layer perceptron. Blow that thing out, like, 10 layers deep and 1,000 neurons wide, and now we're starting to get into deep learning, but even that still, it's not that, that's not even very deep. As you can imagine, this is very computationally expensive compared to multiplying a couple matrices together. When to use deep learning? You like magic. We just throw all our problems in deep learning and then it solves them for us and everything's fine. So always is a good time to use it. You don't care about computational costs. Let's see, trying to get a new job, need some deep learning on the old resume, it's a good time to use deep learning. And
a silly question about the, so the back propagation, that's all training, so it's expensive to train, but like actually using it, is that an expensive operation to
make? Comparatively, no, predictions aren't as bad. It wouldn't be, it's more than like a linear regression, because you still like, but it's trivial. I would say once you have it trained, it's not, I mean, it depends how low latency you're trying to go. It's not as going to be as good as a logistic regression, like the predictions from that. It's still going to have a lot of calculations to do, but it will probably be trivial. But it's the training is the very expensive part, I would say. So, but they are super great when you have absolutely no idea of your data structure. How many people are familiar with Bayesian networks, causality networks? Heard of? The neural network and all of its magic and like secret sauce is really a brute force method for solving causality networks, in my opinion. I don't know, you can quote me, but that's all it is. You could, if you thought about it, you could build a causality network, but we've just built like this huge set of, this huge network, and we'll just, there's a causality network in there somewhere, and we're just brute force solving it. Again, personal opinion, but that's kind of what they come down to. But when you have no idea what the structure is, you know, to do a causality or Bayesian network, you have to have some idea of what the hell's going, like, how things relate. What is the causality? What are the latent variables? Neural network says, I don't know, and it's going to take too long to find out, so let's just let it go. If you don't need, you don't, what, and the second part, no one cares how your model works. It's okay to be black box. This is not a weak requirement. When you get into any kind of like finance, healthcare, regular things that with regulatories, really don't like to hear, like, I don't know how it works, it's just magic. It's still not an acceptable answer for a lot of these types. So deep learning is right out. You need to be able to say, here's how it works, here's why, and here's my parameters. I saw a good joke, actually, that I should have thrown in here.
Deep learning is when you have a self-driving car that almost never crashes, but when it does, no one knows why. And that's the deep learning side. And that's why regulators hate it, because they have no idea, like, what's the kinks in it? Like, where could it go wrong? Oh no, it rarely will though. Okay, great. So, and high dimensional output space too. You see deep learning applied to images a lot, and this is why. You've got an image, you have a collection of images, and you want to like identify if there is a cat and where the cat is. Well, it's a high dimensional output space. It's the entire image, and it's trying to like identify cat pixels. That's a really good use. You can have, I just have this one Y here, it's kind of big, but keeping in mind, this could go to, if I had 5,000 neurons here, it could go to 5,000 neurons as my output. So I could be predicting 5,000 things simultaneously. That's a pretty cool trick. Not a lot of things can do that. So I'm going the wrong way, me. All right, use cases. Scenario, fleet maintenance, because that's what we said we were gonna do. Two ways that fleet, all right, so we're trying to get this into a useful application of this. You know, it's fun, it's cool that we can stream things and have a whole fleet and it's scalable. How are we gonna make money? Why is this gonna be of value to the customers? You can predict engine failures, or you can try to. Another thing you can do is recommend drivers be retrained. Because you know what's really hard on cars? People. Hard braking, hard accelerations, just really being abusive. And so we're gonna kind of play through each one. This ODB2 sensor can read throttle positions, it can read hard accelerations, hard brakes, engine codes. We would have a bunch of things that we were gonna look at, and this is what we would, and we'd pick the ones that we wanted. We're loading our stuff from the Edge device into Kafka. The bad driver, our primary action is gonna be service required. We don't have to worry about having, you've not seen this video before, there's some idiot with their brand new Ferrari. The primary action is gonna be, we had to have service. We've got these secondary actions of hard accelerations, hard brakings, driver experience, and we want to, what we're really doing is of all of our drivers, we're recommending, if we can recommend that a car needs maintenance just because someone was driving it, that's how we know that, okay, this is a driver that maybe could use some retraining and we could save some money. Okay. So here's what that stack's gonna look like. ODB2 sensor to Kafka, you're gonna be saving your data, loaded into Spark plus Mahout for training. That's where you're gonna load that initial training step. There's more than it. Is this? Maybe not. I guess for this advanced example, you're not even, it's really just a Kafka thing. You still throw some Flink or something in there because this is a lot of work just to not keep data streaming. But it's a very simple exercise because all you're doing is collecting data and seeing when did a vehicle need maintenance and is it based on the driver. A more exciting one is gonna be predicting what maintenance is needed, when it's needed, is it a high priority maintenance or is it low priority? And so in this case, our secondary is gonna be our primary action is gonna be what's the maintenance needed? If you think products in an e-commerce case, it's going to be an oil change, needs new brakes, needs coolant checked, needs transmission checked. So there's three kind of scenarios of how you build your stack and architecture. The first one is everything's happening on the server. Things load up from your Edge device into Kafka. We're training our stuff in the Apache Spark, Apache Mahout, you know, we're doing all our training. The matrices, all of the training values are calculated offline, loaded into Flink, which is handling them on a case-by-case basis and doing its learning in real time. For those who like buzzwords, this is called a Lambda architecture of machine learning. The other way we can do this is we push everything out to the Edge. Probably heard a lot about this if you've been hanging out on the IoT track. In this case, I'm tweaking it. You know, I said maybe we've got a Raspberry Pi we could use. Well, I think you're gonna need one. You're not gonna be able to push this back to this commercial thing that wasn't built to do it. But we'll say we've got some sort of Raspberry Pi or a device with a little more kick to it out in the vehicle. Cool. We run through, we program, we push everything back to the device, and so all those recommendations are being made at the device level. I'm calling this matrices. Another way to do this, and I don't know why I didn't rig it out as such, you can also do your training on Flink in the real time. You can get into like a lot of weird different architectures here. It was late last night. I was playing fast and loose with my copy paste on slides. But you're going to have your stream processor here that's going to be learning in real time and pushing basically the parameters of the learn model back down to the edge device. So the only thing that this thing is sending out after an initial training period is the results, because it's got its parameter space and it's making decisions locally, like, hey, pull over, hey, change my oil, hey, do whatever you need to do. The grown-up way, for lack of a better word, that also, supposing all the vehicles are going to be somewhere with good network connectivity, is a microservice approach. And the way this would work, the idea here is, all right, we go, we load, we calculate, load all your parameters into microservice. Now, the edge device hits up the microservice, and that's how it makes its decisions. Again, if a lot of your fleet's going to be out in the boondoggles with no internet connection, this might not be great. But these are three different stack and architecture approaches to how you would want to build this sort of thing. And the most important thing is, and I hope I've driven this point home, because I've been swapping in and out components, and we've talked about the different swappable components to all these places, the point being is that you can build a professional grade, scalable, buzzword stack for IoT, vehicle transportation IoT stuff, purely out of Apache project, roll your own, connectors are in place. Things we brought up here, obviously there's considerations. It's not gonna be turnkey like going out to a company and buying a solution, but you know, every problem's different, and maybe the company doesn't have something for your fleet that you need, or they're trying to sell you everything in a kitchen sink, and you're like, nah, man, I'm just gonna Kafka, little this, little that, sprinkle in, done. So, food for thought. So I will open up to questions about stuff.
Seems like the microservice would be a smarter way of getting around the security updates and stuff like that for a lot of these edge IoT. You start putting Raspberry Pis in your car.
Yeah.
The car gets hacked. It's a pain in the ass.
I believe it.
Only sending out a port 80 request and getting a port 80 back.
Yeah.
It's a lot safer and cleaner.
And like I said, it is 100% the way I feel like this, like online like streaming algorithms and like real-time scoring and all that's going, is the microservice approach. I think, except in edge cases where network connectivity is not possible. But even then, okay, network connectivity is not possible. Okay, well, the whole thing's broken down then. I mean, except where you've got it on the edge device taking its stuff, but like, or maybe you have redundancies. Maybe when it's back at home base, it gets updated with parameters. I don't know. I'm just talking out of my derriere. So I'm just making things up. Thought exercises. Other stuff? All right. Well, if you have more intelligent IoT-based questions, definitely get a hold of Joe Olson. And he's not on LinkedIn, and he brags about it. I don't think he's barely on Twitter. Find him if you can. And thanks for coming out so early in the morning. I hope everyone's enjoyed Miami. I'm babbling. I'm done.